You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
I'm Jim Leffel, and it's my privilege to wear a number of different hats in our fellowship over a lot of decades at this point. And one of the things that I do and I'm pretty excited about is work with our global partners. And so in keeping with the theme of our conference this year, which is this question of neighboring, or what does it mean to be community, we're raising this question, who is my neighbor in the global village? And so that's the context that we want to begin to think about, because the whole notion of community, the whole idea of neighborhood, actually has been in a radical change over the course of the last generation. The idea or the concept of global village goes back really into the mid-1960s. It's a term that was coined by Marshall McLuhan, the Canadian philosopher, who people kind of know, have heard the expression, the medium is the message. That's the guy who coined that. And he did that to capture this idea that he saw the future unfolding as a global village, as a network wired together through communication that would enable people all over the world to almost instantaneously connect with one another. That's kind of amazing coming from 1965. But we see it today, and it's a part of our reality. It's amazing to me. I am really, I'm a technological idiot. But I was given a smartphone by my son who said, you're an idiot and you need this. And it's got this thing called WhatsApp. Do you know WhatsApp? I was maybe the last person to find out what that meant. But through it, instantaneously, I can talk to friends literally all over the world in real time, right now. We are connected. A number of years ago, my sister and her family, they lived in the Amazon basin and in Brazil. And I went to visit them, and she said, I'm going to show you, you know, where we're working. So we got on this boat and spent the whole day going up the Amazon. We were way out in the middle of nowhere, and we stopped at a village in which there was no running water and no electricity, but it had a huge satellite dish and a bay of car batteries and a TV in which everyone was watching soccer and American television. We're connected. The whole idea of world culture has kind of come into a thing. The internet has connected us in such a way that the same information that's available here is available over there. It is a blessing. I was thinking about this, how difficult it is to do theological training in developing world countries, places that are too poor to buy books, things like that. But they're not too poor to press a button and download PDFs of really great information. So we live in this global village, or as Thomas Friedman, the New York Times columnist and author, talks about the global marketplace, where what happens in one sector of the world, one nation, one part, has rippling effects all over the place. And so for many of us here with gray hair, we remember the rough days of the early mid-70s in which OPEC decided they're going to stop the flow of gas, which caused a new word to be developed called stagflation. It just absolutely affected the American economy in a fundamental way. And so it is that what happens in one place around the world affects the economy of other places around the world. We are deeply connected with one another. We are, in a very real sense, a global village. And in this sense, I think that the Bible's not surprised by that, because the concept, the understanding of what neighborhood is, what village is in the Bible, really is a lot closer to the modern realities that we face today than the kind of more parochial ideas of neighborhood or village that have defined it in the past. And so, like every other speaker that we have heard this time, I'm going to go to the same passage and glean something slightly different from Luke chapter 10, the story of the Good Samaritan, in which he says, one day an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question, teacher, what should I do to inherit eternal life? Okay, so this is a weighty question. This is an important question. This is not a peripheral thing. This gets to the nuts and bolts about what is most important in life, right? To which Jesus then responds, what does the law of Moses say? How do you read it? And the man answered, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, right, do this and you will live. So, clear enough. The moral, spiritual center of God's will for humanity is to love God with our total being and our neighbor as ourselves. That's Old Testament. That comes from Leviticus. It's way back there. But Jesus makes the point that all of the law and the prophets, the whole thing, really kind of hinges upon this summary. He goes on then, because he wants to justify himself, and he asks Jesus, okay, then, so who is my neighbor? And he's wanting to justify himself, so you see some motivations there that are nefarious, but at the same time, it's an interesting question. And what exactly is a neighbor, and what does it therefore mean to have obligations to love? And just a few things to keep in mind here. One would be a neighbor is someone who is in close proximity. And so last night, Jay was talking about being in a neighborhood and knowing your neighbors, and that's so critically important, especially us urban dwellers, to be able to connect with people who are coming and going. We've got a period of time to know them and to really be an ambassador for Christ to those who God has called in space and time to live next to us. But then, too, there is the idea that, won't you be my neighbor, right? So Mr. Rogers invites everyone who's under the age of 4 to be his neighbor. Because why? Because he's someone who's friendly, he's neighborly. And so what defines neighbor is has some kind of quality that draws or attracts or connects to another. Or affinity, the idea that it's somebody that I work with or who shares a common interest. And I think that that's really an important part of this, that the idea of neighbor has really shifted over time in a significant way, so that it is true, and especially in our larger cities. It's extremely difficult to know our neighbors. And so the people that we are connecting with and have a sense of stewardship in that relationship tend to be the people that we are meeting from work, from the gym, places like that. I remember years ago when we lived in Chicago and we were going out into the neighborhood that we lived in, we were doing surveys, which were just basically, you know, spiritual opinions and things like that. There were opportunities to meet people and to interact with them about the gospel. And we lived in an apartment like, I don't know, 90% of the people in Chicago do. And it became evident, you know, after the first day, we fanned out to start talking to people and realized, you push the button, no answer. You push the button, no answer. And you realize, my neighbors are not my neighbors. They are aliens. They are foreign. They are out there somewhere. I have no access to them at all. And so it is with a lot of the way the world operates, is that affinity really is the base of relationship building and therefore of neighboring. Or lastly, neighborhoods are conceived of as community, somebody that I identify with, someone who's like me. And so we talk about ethnic communities, right? Or lifestyle enclaves, as the sociologist Robert Bella called them, in Habits of the Heart. The idea that we form bonds and take responsibility for people that we in some important, visceral way share with the same identity. And so those, I think, are all pretty good facets on the gem that is this concept of neighbor. But as we all know, Jesus goes a bit of a different direction with it. And so he says, in reply to the man who's trying to justify himself, he says, a Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho, was attacked by bandits. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him up, and left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along, but when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and he passed him by. Similarly, a temple assistant walked over and looked at him lying there, but he also passed by on the other side. Then a despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him. Going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them. Then he put the man on his own donkey, and he took him to an inn where he took care of him. And the next day he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, saying, "Take care of this man, and if the bill runs higher than this, I'll pay you the next time that I'm there." And so then Jesus poses a question, as we were talking about last night, answering questions with questions. Jesus says, "Now, which of these 3 would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by the bandits?" And the man replied, "Of course, the one who showed mercy." So now we have a different definition offered for what does it mean to be a neighbor, to which Jesus replies, "Yes, now go and do the same." So we not only have a refashioning of the meaning of neighbor, but we also have a more focused imperative that relates to it. Do you see what I'm saying? Okay, and so what we want to do is we want to break that down just a little bit. We want to understand. Think about the Samaritan just for a second. The good Samaritan carried, there are 3 things about this guy that were just fundamentally different than anything else in the scene. First, that he's from a separate region. He's from Samaria, not from Judea, right? So that makes him an outsider in that sense. But the outsider still is a person that captures this idea of obligation to neighbor. That he's a different ethnicity, and you know, because Samaritans weren't just geographically defined, but they were ethnically defined. They were people who had intermarried with Assyrians from as far back as 722 BC, when Assyria came and conquered the 10 northern tribes, and their way of conquest was to intermarry and to dilute ethnic identity, and therefore to dilute aspirations of reclaiming ancestral land. And so they were kind of like half-breeds in the minds of the Jewish people, the people from Judea, and also with that, of course, the broken relationship that Jesus speaks of to the woman at the well in John chapter 4, where she says, Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. And so here, the Good Samaritan really is working from a position of social deficit in relation to the person that he is a neighbor to, right? It's the Jewish people on Jewish soil. It's between Jericho and Jerusalem that this is taking place. In a certain sense, the Samaritan is out of his league, out of his place, and yet that principle of neighborliness applies to him. So let's think about this just a bit more. It seems to me that when we really get down to it, what Jesus is saying is that the one who needs a neighbor is a neighbor. It's the principle of mercy. If you are in need, it doesn't matter what your proximity is in space and time. It doesn't matter what your affinity is in terms of ethnic identity or similar life situation or things of that nature. What Jesus is doing through the parable is stripping away any means that we might use to qualify the call to love by saying that my neighbor is defined as simply anyone who is in need. And so that's illustrated then by the example of the Samaritan. He doesn't avoid the scene like the religious people do. They walk on the other side, but no, the Samaritan goes right at it. He sees the problem and he moves toward the thing. Not at a safe distance. And I think there's something to be said about that because there's a lot we can do to keep ourselves insulated from the real pressing needs of the neighbors around us, whether that's next door, across the street, or across the world. And so this kind of robs us of that opportunity because in the parable, he's moving toward it. And this is what Jesus is pointing out as what really constitutes being a neighbor. The Samaritan doesn't think about who else should be helping. He's not saying, priest and temple assistant, this is one of your guys, and you should be in there and dealing with this problem. He's not concerned about who else might play a role. he is subject to his own conscience before God without worrying about being the conscience of everybody else. And then, two, he isn't asking, you know, how does she get into this mess to begin with? You know, how foolish it is for this man to have been walking from the place of Jericho to Jerusalem unaccompanied and so forth. He's not victim blaming in that sense. And so to be a neighbor is to move toward the need, not predicated on whether or not the person qualifies for our assistance. I think that's also an important piece, and it kind of relates to this last one, which is that he doesn't consider whether the neighborliness is deserved. What does he say? He says, the lawyer says, the person who is the neighbor is the one who showed mercy. Well, theologically, we have a term for what mercy is, which is what? It's grace. Okay? It's unmerited, undeserved favor that comes at a cost to the one who is granting it. And so this is kind of the framework or the picture out of which the principles that are then applied to this question of, once we define who our neighbor is, how then do we move towards them? And so that's what I want to kind of think about here. Again, not just salving the wound on the street, but taking him in and dealing with those problems. And it seems to me, in fact, that the Christian community is uniquely suited to be neighbors. And in a very important, three important ways. That Christians are uniquely prepared to be neighbors in the global village, first because we have a basis for human dignity. Okay? We believe that every human being is created in the image of God, and because we are all in the image of God, we are all equal, we all equally merit the resources of those who have on behalf of those who don't. Right? We believe that. But if we take this biblical view out of the way, what are we left with? A karmic principle that the universe is giving you what you deserve? Where's the mercy in that? Or the naturalistic view that says that essentially we are just complex compilations of biological mass with no more intrinsic value than any other mass, and therefore justice would certainly just be the interest of the stronger. And so we can imagine how that works out as well. And we can kind of extrapolate from there. And I want to say that there are many, you know, deeply humanitarian people who are atheists and who are from the East. And so I don't want to disparage individual acts that are deeply Christian in their definition. But I would want to say that the basis and the ability to sustain that kind of compassion and to spread the burden for that kind of compassion cannot be built on a naturalistic or an Eastern foundation, because it simply doesn't have the robust understanding of why people matter and why, at the end of the day, you should sacrifice for the good or the interests of another. So this is, I think, super important, and therefore obviously becomes a part of our witness, doesn't it? Because we are doing something that illustrates our commitment to something that everyone recognizes and values but has no answer for. Second, there is a unique opportunity because we are called to go and do the same. It's not a suggestion. It's not a good idea. It's not an inspiring concept. It is a command. It's an imperative. He said, live like the Samaritan. Right? And then lastly, and I just feel like this also needs to be said, is that the legacy of the Christian movement, the world Christian movement, is significantly undervalued in the area of being a good Samaritan. And there is a rap about how missionaries have destroyed culture and introduced ideas that are unhelpful to indigenous populations. Is that true? Yes, I think that's true. But that's not the whole story. That's not even a huge, significantly huge part of the story. The real story in the history of the Christian mission worldwide is the legacy of educational systems that actually function in the developing world, of hospitals that people depend upon in the developing world that would not be there for any other reason than that people in the name of Christ came and started these things and committed their lives and their careers, much as the Benedims and others in working at Mercy Medical in Cambodia are doing. They are fitting into that broader legacy that has been the Christian movement for the last couple hundred years. But even more than just simply building compassion infrastructure, it is also the fruit of the people who have come to name Christ as their Savior and as their Lord in the world that has neighbors that need us the most, that show real transformation and real power. Many of us, I think, have been aware, because it's been passed around all over the Christian world over the last few years, of the essay written some years ago by the British journalist Matthew Paris on Christmas Eve 2008. Here's a guy who grew up in Africa in Malawi and is a deeply committed atheist. But here's what he writes. He says, "Now a confirmed atheist, I've become convinced of the enormous contribution that Christian evangelism makes in Africa, sharply distinct from the work of secular NGOs, government projects, international efforts, aid efforts. These alone will not do. Education and training will not do. In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real and the change is good." Now, I've had a chance to work in the last 10 years in Africa a fair amount, and that's exactly what I see is people who, in an inward way, are different from their neighbors because they know Christ. Anxiety, fear of evil spirits, of ancestors, of nature and of the wild, of tribal hierarchy, strikes deep into the whole structure of rural African thought. He says, "In Africa, Christianity changes people's hearts. It brings a spiritual transformation. The rebirth is real. The change is good. Every man has his place, and call it fear or respect, a great weight grinds down the individual spirit, stunting curiosity. People won't take initiative, won't take things into their own hands or on their own shoulders. It's just something that's been carved into their culture over years of colonial rule and before that, tribal rule. Christianity, though, post-Reformation, post-Luther, with its teaching of a direct personal two-way link between the individual and God, unmediated by the collective and unsubordinate to any other human being, smashes straight through the tribal philosophical spiritual framework. It offers something to hold on to those who are anxious to cast off a crushing tribal groupthink. That is why it liberates and how it liberates. And removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of the malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete." This is an atheist who is basically saying, let the church do its thing, because that is what we really need. It's the fruit of being true neighbors in that biblical sense. So what I want to do then is let's apply this a bit to the situation that we find among our neighbors in the world today. Our neighbors, many of our neighbors, are in peril, just as that Jewish man was as he was lying wounded and abandoned on the road. This is a map from the World Bank, and it shows from light color down to just jet black the percentages of the population that are dealing with poverty. Poverty defined in terms of annual income, poverty as it relates to access to education, poverty as it relates to access to water, potable water, poverty as it relates to employment possibility, poverty as it relates to access to food. Okay? And so you can see there is a problem, and a desperate problem. I want to kind of roll that out here for just a bit. Here is an old graphic I had worked up for me by a friend, Dan Beach, some years ago, in which we conceive of the world being, you know, somewhere in the area of 1,000 people. And if that's the case, then a quarter of them are living with an annual income of around $430, U.S. dollars. About 10% right now are living below that in a significant way, actually, according to the most recent World Bank numbers. But what that means is that they are food insecure, is the word, that they don't know necessarily where their next meal is coming from. They don't have the resources available to them to meet even the most basic physical needs. They don't drink healthy water, and so they're sick, and their children are dying. The child mortality rate super high in this population. The idea of education and a better life is almost entirely off the table. These people are in crisis. Then there is what we called slum town, which is again a very sizable percentage of the population, which would have an annual income of about $100 a month. And so here are people who more reliably eat, but any kind of change in politics or change in weather is going to impinge upon that, and they're going to sink down to where they, many of them, came from. It's a real tenuous existence. Most of their children do not finish high school. Very few of them will go on to relocate into a city or some place where they can go and actually become educated and elevate into a so-called middle-class environment, which would be defined here as low-income city, and this would be an income of about $5,000 a year. And so in much of the developing world, there is that thin line, 33 people out of 1,000 who kind of fit that middle tier. And so that's an elastic kind of category. And frankly, over the last 20 years, that category has grown. I think that's actually a good sign. I'm not entirely negative about this. The global marketplace that people talk about so much and how we are building internationally actually has turned out to be a pretty good thing for an awful lot of people. And so I'm kind of thankful for that. Actually, that kind of entrepreneurship that is elevating by sending textile industries to Africa and other kinds of things to Asia and places like that has actually been a good thing. Then here is the kind of the first world situation. 18% of the world that lives comfortably, that doesn't worry about any of the things that define what poverty is. And why is that important? It's important because the separation between where we are at in the West and the rest of the world is so drastic that it's almost comical to look down and see what the rest of the world looks like. It's just, you can see images on a TV and it just seems like a cartoon. It just seems like something not real. It just seems like, is this science fiction or what? But the reality is that this thing isn't up. The reality is this is a two-scale model. That the poverty level for a U.S. family of four is $25,500. That's how we define poverty. With full access to education, water, food, medical help, all of it, right? But the majority world, 71% of the world, in fact, has none of those things. That's significant. Now, let's look at it from a different point of view. Let's think about it geographically. Here is Asia, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, and here into Western Asia. Almost the entire subcontinent of Africa and big swaths of Latin and Central America fit into this population percentage defined by less than $1.90 a day per household. per household. And you can just see the enormous scope of the pain that is involved and the huge numbers that are related to that. Here's another kind of snapshot about our neighbors. This is from the Lausanne Conference on World Evangelization, in which they define the world spiritually in kind of five categories in relation to the gospel. Or on the one hand, there are the countries in red that have a strong, vital Christian presence. Even if it's diminishing, there are a lot of Christians in America, right? Bunch of us. And we have lots of freedom and lots of ability to do. And it kind of goes all the way up to what they call pioneer populations, in which there is no internal church that is in any way sustainable at all. And so there are countries in which that is the case. And then there are these things in between, which he calls partner groups, which have some indigenous Christian population, but it's a small one, and one that is not going to be able to sustain itself without outside help, without help from neighbors. Or support really is the same kind of context, where there is in many ways an established Christian presence, perhaps in one tribal identity group or whatever, but it doesn't cover the whole nation or the whole region. And so they are unable to accomplish the Great Commission with the resources they have. Follow me? Okay, so here's the interesting thing. This area right here looks a lot like this area right here. You see that? Our neighbors defined by those who what? Are in need, are both materially and spiritually deeply at risk. And it is unmistakable that where the gospel has taken root and where the gospel has affected lives and affected culture, it has also affected the conditions under which people live. And so that brings us to this summary by the Joshua Project, who tracks these things. They say, of the poorest of the poor, more than 8 out of 10 live in the 1040 window. That's that place in sub-Saharan Africa across East Asia. On average, they exist on less than a few $100 per person per year. It has been said that the poor are the lost, and the lost are the poor. Blessed be the poor. As the majority of the unreached live in the poorest countries of the world, there is a remarkable overlap between the poorest countries of the world and those that are least evangelized. So that then really raises this question for us, doesn't it, about what does it mean to be in one of those red, dark red countries with a robust Christian presence with abundant resources? What are our priorities then for being neighbors? And so I want to talk a little bit about that in the time that we have left. I want to talk about partnering with near neighbors as the center of a strategy for reaching today's global village. I am so optimistic, frankly, about where we are in relation to the task of global evangelism. More excited than I've ever been in my life. And there are reasons for that. Here is what we call strategic global partnerships. That's what we have. That's the center of our dartboard here at Dwell Community Church. It's not the circumference. In other words, there are things that we're invested in that don't fit these criteria, but which are important and that we want to stay invested in and are behind. But we have strategic global partnerships in Haiti, in Ecuador, in the Ivory Coast, in Ethiopia, in Moldova, as an attempt to reach out to train and reach people who can go back to the stands, the former Soviet republics. India, through the India Gospel League. We have three partners in Cambodia, Hope for Cambodia's Children, Fountain of Hope, and Mercy Medical Clinic. And then in East Asia, among the Sundanese primarily. Those are our major strategic global partners. And there are four things about them that we think really apply this principle of neighborliness and the priorities that the gospel sets out. First, that we want to focus on indigenous leadership. So even if we have people from this church, as we do, going to places as career missionaries, we have been doing that for 30 years, we'll continue doing that in various ways, the object is the same in each case, is to identify and develop indigenous leadership. People who know the language, who know how to live in the environment where the lost people are the vast majority. People who often know how to live in deep poverty. And people who God has raised up. And so I think there is something of a bit of a change in mission philosophy that we have embraced here, and which is, I think, broader to be sure among Western churches as involved in the mission activity, that we think of ourselves much more as facilitators than pioneers. And metaphors do matter. A pioneer is one who goes off and into their own, you know, out to the West and does their thing, and we get letters back every now and then from the Pony Express, but they're gone. And it's their, you know, their work. And what we think is that in most places in the world, God has raised up effective leaders, people who are gifted apostolically, people who know their culture well enough to be way ahead of where we are with the right resources to get the job done. So we think that partnering with indigenous leadership is going to enable us to be vastly more effective than if we just kind of went in there and figured it out and began doing it ourselves. The first part of our global partnership strategy is to focus on the people that God has already raised up on the ground, to equip them, to give them the resources that they need to be neighbors to their neighbors. I wish I could show you how that actually looks like, because it's kind of cool. But there is that piece. There is the piece that we are working among least reached populations. That's a value for us, that we want to highlight those places in the world where the gospel has... We want to go where the gospel is not deeply established, instead of places where it has. We want to work hard among the poor. So among the poor, the least reached, and then also the responsive. And we feel like this is a principle of mission philosophy that is very important, that we go where the field is ripe for harvest and where help is needed. And it matters that we go places that are able to bring large numbers of people to Christ, because that will seed the ongoing Christian work and Christian mission, as we'll describe here. Our partnering is to build capacity of our partners to their near neighbors. Really important thing. Three things I want to talk about briefly. Is that we're living in a world of increased dislocation and migration. People are on the move in the hundreds of millions. And so there's lots of static in American culture about the border, right? And that's a concern for us. But do we understand people are migrating north out of misery and out of violence, but they're also migrating south? They're going from Nicaragua and Honduras and Guatemala south to places like Ecuador. And so, as it turns out, that has actually turned out to be a boon for church planting. So as we, here's an example. We see it in Ecuador with all these Venezuelans fleeing a collapsing culture. They're going south more really than they're going north. And you know what they're finding? They're finding Arco Church in Ecuador, and they're finding Christ, and they have every intent, when the coast is clear, to go back to Venezuela and to plant churches. That's sweet. And we see that same kind of thing with this location. For instance, in Africa, And so people in Eritrea who are desperately poor, people in the Darfur region of South Sudan, people in Niger and Mali that are desperately poor, desperately broken, and totally unreached are migrating. And where are they going? They're going to Morocco, which, by the way, is totally unreached, right? Why are they going to Morocco? So they can get into Europe. That's exactly right. And so every dime they have or have stolen or borrowed, they literally are walking across the Sahara Desert to Morocco. They're dying along the way, but they're getting there. And then they're entrusting what little resources they have to these people who say, sure, we've got a boat and we'll take you to Gibraltar or Spain or something like that. And they don't. They die. Now there are hundreds of thousands of migrants living in Morocco from all over the last world of sub-Saharan Africa. But we have a partner in Ivory Coast. And that partner has a woman who has loved her experience in a house church and has experienced planting and birthing a house church and gets it. And for business reasons, she has moved to Morocco. And when she got there, what did she see? An ocean of need. To which she thought, hey, how's about a house church? She now has a network of 17 house churches in Morocco, completely committed to, devoted to, people from these ethnicities that are on the move, who are unreached, and who have family. And the gospel will not only take root here, but it's going to go back where those family lines are. And oddly enough, to Paris, France, where there is now a small community of house churches from this ministry, because people have succeeded in migrating to Europe, found their way to France because it's, you know, the French colonies of Africa. Long story. Anyway, that's how the gospel is spreading through migration. It's just keeping your eyes open, saying, who's my neighbor? And it's just happening in a fairly organic, natural way. Tribal and ethnic near neighbors. So we're supporting gifted leadership in various places. Southeast Asia began years ago with Christian background believers, people who are tribally not related to the core ethnic population that is this huge unreached people group. But they are close enough to understand them, to get the language, to live in that environment, and to succeed in church planting. That's just awesome. That's how that works. It's not by sending a bunch of us, a few of us, but rather building a team of near neighbor Christians who can carry on this work. Same thing with the barefoot pastors of India. They're reaching near neighbors. The Indian subcontinent is the largest unreached people population in the world. And the reality is that there are thousands of indigenous church planters that don't show up on our studies oftentimes of what's happening in missions today. But there are thousands of near neighbor Christians who are going to the village next door with a different ethnic identity, who are totally lost and are dedicating themselves, their lives, their families, to the gospel in these communities. And the same thing is happening in Ethiopia. Our dear friend Lou, who's been over there now for almost 10 years, did I find out? I think 10 years now. Shocking. He's gotten a beard now, and he's older. He's got gray hair. It's frightening. Anyway, he went over to win the Amharic, the largest people group in East Africa that have not been won for Christ. And along the way, just happens to find that the Oromo and the Tigray are also super open spiritually. So now they have a network of 2,500 people who are meeting in house churches all over the north of Ethiopia, and these are the foundations of work that will continue to go out from there. A network of house church planters crossing ethnic lines into the areas of the unreached. Our friends in the Ivory Coast are of one tribal identity, but are reaching the 32 unreached tribal identities of Ivory Coast. And along the way, while a lot of this is very intentional, it's planned. In Ivory Coast, they're crossing tribal lines and planting churches among the unreached tribal peoples of central and northern Côte d'Ivoire. And so the cool thing is that Africa is tribal, and which means that national borders just don't mean that much. And so what's happening is people are finding business opportunities, family connections in neighboring countries. And now what was started out as 800 people in southern Côte d'Ivoire is a network of well over 10,000 people in 4 years in all over Côte d'Ivoire, Benin, Mali, starting now in Togo, up here in Morocco. It's just natural, spontaneous expansion. Because why? Because they're being neighborly. It's just the only thing is that they're just saying, what are the needy people in our life? Let's just take what we've got. Let's go after them. And what's occurring in all of these places is a sense of agitation and excitement that God is at work. And so these groups are growing. They're expanding significantly, and in some cases, historically. The Muslim people of Southeast Asia have been unreached for, you know, the last couple hundred years since the Dutch started trying to do it. But now they're being reached in significant numbers. So there's leading with compassion. And so we've got groups that are where we're partnering, and they're opening up educational facilities, using Compassion International to work with children, hospital, things like that, public health. And that is opening up doors to significant expansion. And so just because we're out of time, let me just draw three conclusions real quick. One is Jesus says, go and do the same. Not a suggestion. It's his call on the church. We are neighbors and neighbors to near neighbors in the global village with our unique opportunity, stewardship, and calling. It's our job. It's our calling as a church, because our neighbors are not just across the street. They are across the world. And the call of God is to the world, right? And so if we are able to effectively find our place, our role at facilitating, catalyzing, mobilizing indigenous works in those windows that we showed a while ago where there is deep poverty and where there is deep spiritual poverty, then God, I think, will honor this work. The Lord's work done the Lord's way has the Lord's provision, as Oswald Sanders said so many years ago. And if we do things his way, I think that we will see the fruit of that. This is the right thing to do. This is where God is moving now. And which brings me to my second point, which is that this is an historically great day to be neighbors. It is just amazing. We are so connected. And there are more people coming to Christ today than at any time since the first century. That's a fact. More people are coming to know Christ today than at any time in church history. And there is a common ground for how that's happening. It's happening through houses. People opening up their homes to their neighbors. And they're loving their neighbors. And they're coming in and they're finding Christ. And they're multiplying house churches all over these places that didn't have churches before. And it is amazing. I'm so optimistic that what we're on the right track, that God has got the church globally moving in this direction, that we have a part, a stake in that. That Dwell Community Church is not simply the 4,000 people here in Columbus, but the 20,000 people that are meeting all over Asia and Africa and parts of South and Central America. And those groups are going to continue to grow. Our goal for these global partners is that by 2025, that we'll have at least 45,000 people in weekly house church meetings together. We're past the mark where that's not just possible, but we're going to exceed that goal. Ahead of schedule and scalable, okay? Because why? Because it doesn't take a degree in rocket science to know how to lead a Bible study and to pray for and love your neighbor. And that's what's happening in these houses all over the place, and it's changing the world. I'm so optimistic about that and grateful for our chance to play a role. So I'm just asking you to get a little more informed, to get connected with what's going on in global mission here with our partners. And you can do that by doing the dwellcc.org on your interweb thing. But just thanks, Lord, for this teaching about who is our neighbor that you gave so many years ago, and just seems like it could not be more relevant than it is today, and informing as it does our global mission, our vision as a church. Just help us, God, to not be afraid, but to move towards the need that's there. Help us to be generous in our thoughts and in our contribution. And Lord, just help us to be the kind of neighbors globally that you call on us to be at this unique moment in time. Help us to, Lord, to see these last generations of people before you return have victory in their places of labor. So just thanks again for this church and for the legacy of sacrifice and commitment that has been evident and indeed evident in this room, locally, nationally, internationally. Just thank you so much in Christ's name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.